laying out the immigration case was the policy meat of President Trump's first official State of the Union address last night. He devoted nearly 650 words to immigration. He reiterated his willingness to make concessions that would include limited amnesty in exchange for changes to the legal immigration system and a wall. We're exploring the facets of immigration and connecting the dots right here in Wisconsin. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The portion of the president's speech addressing immigration focused on the danger he says ongoing policies pose.
For decades, open borders have allowed drugs and gangs to pour into our most vulnerable communities. They've allowed millions of low-wage workers to compete for jobs and wages against the poorest Americans.
Now let's consider what immigration looks like in Wisconsin and whether the president's words translate here. Rachel Ida Buff is an immigration historian. She's a professor at UW-Milwaukee, where she's president of the school's chapter of the American Association of University Professionals. Her most recent book is Against the Deportation Terror, Organizing for Immigrant Rights in the 20th Century. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Wisconsin has thousands of immigrants living, working, going to school here. Who's coming to Wisconsin and what brings them here?
Well, that's a complicated question. We have about 250,000 immigrants at the last census. About 5% of the Wisconsin population is foreign-born, and about 7% of Wisconsin residents have at least one foreign-born parent. 22% of farmers, fishers, and foresters are foreign-born, and 12% of our computer and mathematics experts are foreign-born. So people are coming. The largest numbers are in Wisconsin right now are from Mexico, India, Laos, Thailand, and China for a blend of reasons. Many of them, when we talk about Mexican and Central American, which are smaller but significant populations, leave areas that have been economically devastated by international trade policies such as the North American Free Trade Agreement and the Central American Free Trade Agreement. So, for example, I very often have students who say to me, "Listen, I don't discriminate, but I know that my family in Wisconsin, who's been here for a couple of generations, has had a really hard time economically, and at the same time that my family is struggling, I see other immigrants coming here, and they seem to be," you could look at that and say, well, the one is causing the other, when in fact both are suffering certain economic downturns that have been caused by the same global trade and economic policies. People leave countries for economic reasons, for political reasons. They come seeking better opportunities and safety for themselves and their families, and find productive work here.
Let's explore some of the work that they do here. We often hear about the dairy industry having a number of people who are immigrant workers. Is that true?
Absolutely. The dairy industry in particular, because it's the largest agricultural industry in the state, is entirely reliant on foreign-born, mostly Latino, significantly undocumented labor in this state. So you've had this experience, I'm sure, where you're in a small town and you're thinking, oh, this is rural America, which imaginatively, not historically, is kind of a white space, and it isn't. It's, you see lots of Latinos, there's a Mexican restaurant downtown, and there's a grocery store, and you can send money abroad. This is because of the deep reliance of our most significant agriculture on foreign-born labor. For this reason, for example, you see third- and fourth-generation German-American farmers, many of them deeply Republican, deeply conservative, coming to immigrant rights marches in this day and age and saying, you know, we really need respect and honor the contributions of our Latino and undocumented laborers. That's what our state looks like right now. That's what our schools look like. That's what our communities look like. We are interdependent.
We heard President Trump say last night on the State of the Union that undocumented workers are taking away jobs, that America's poor need to have a chance. Do you see that in Wisconsin?
Absolutely not. And the most important thing I can say about the 600 words addressed to immigration last night in the presidential address, as well as to a year of devastating, cruel, and impractical policies towards the foreign-born, is there is no motivation economically. We also heard last night that jobs are up, employment is up, the economy is up. A study by the Brookings Institute says that 90% of native-born Americans benefit from the presence of immigrants in terms of their pocketbook. We're not talking culture. We're not talking salsa. We're talking about native-born Americans with a high school education making more money because there are immigrants driving the economy in Wisconsin and elsewhere. So there is no economic reason to restrict immigration. There is no public safety reason to restrict immigration. Immigrants commit crimes at a far lower rate than native-born people. So the only reason to restrict immigration is to pander to white supremacist politics. The immigration restriction politicians come from a eugenics standpoint. The Federation for American Immigration Reform is an organization that is in its basis and in its outlook eugenic. In other words, it feels that only European Americans can produce the kind of country we need, and other people, other races have no business here. So there is no political reason to restrict immigration. There is no economic reason. The only reason it is political is to pander to white nationalists and white supremacists. Politics. There's no other reason.
We're talking right now with UW-Milwaukee immigration historian Rachel Ida Buff, exploring the topic of immigration, how it relates to Wisconsin, and takeaways from the State of the Union. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a DACA recipient? Do you live in a household with people of different immigration status? Help us understand your story, your perspective. How do you think the U.S. should reform immigration? What is the answer? 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at WPR Morning. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Rachel, some people say the term chain migration, and let's pause for a moment on what chain migration is. Others say it's family reunification. What are we talking about? Parse these terms for us.
Sure, thanks. Chain migration is what most of us who came from another country voluntarily, so that leaves out Africans who came in chains, right, and built this country. Most people who come to America from other countries, come to the United States, follow a path of chain migration. I mean, you can ask around in your family, but certainly in my family, chain migration means someone comes over and establishes a life here, and then they send for the other people. In my family, that's because Jews in the Pale of Settlement couldn't afford to all come over at once. So in my family, as in many immigrant families, there's a lot of stories about, you know, dad came first, mom came later, maybe an older sister at the ripe old age of 14 had to come by herself because that's what they could afford. That's chain migration. That's how the vast numbers of people who are here now got to the United States. So to say we're going to end chain migration is sort of like saying, let's not combine hydrogen and oxygen to make water anymore. We're done with that. It doesn't make any sense. It's how people live.
President Trump used chain migration, and let's listen to a clip from last night's State of the Union speech.
Under the current broken system, a single immigrant can bring in virtually unlimited numbers of distant relatives. Under our plan, we focus on the immediate family by limiting sponsorships to spouses and minor children.
So you hear some members of Congress booing there during that point, others clapping when the president finished his point. What do you make of that assessment, and why do people who take different sides in the immigration debate use different phrases?
Well, I mean, you're probably aware of this as a journalist, that buzzwords carry a lot of power. So I think at this point, the term chain migration has become demonized. Right. So it seems like some kind of weird foreign-born conspiracy, like let's land one. It's rather like the very racist term anchor baby, which is a term given to a foreign-born woman who gives birth to an American citizen, which is something that was decided in 1875 with the 14th Amendment. The Supreme Court decided we do not want to have people who are born here who are second class and can't be citizens. That's in our Constitution. But the term anchor baby is ugly. And chain migration, which used to be just kind of a social science term, meaning how people come and how they send for each other and how they associate, that has become demonized. Now, what the president said last night, we're only going to let minor children and spouses come in, that takes us back to 1924. To the national origins quota immigration restriction, which tried to restrict immigration so that the country would look like it did in 1880. A bunch of congressmen studied it, and they said, you know, there's too many dusky people. And by this, they meant Slavs, Jews, Italians, Greeks, Lebanese people, too many of them. We want to go back to the good old days when everybody was white and Anglo-Saxon. So they changed it and made national origins. And then they said, we'll have quota immigrants, non-quota immigrants, but only the immediate families. Now, the good thing about the non-quota immigrants was it set into policy the notion that family reunification is important. And we have evolved since 1924 to say, you know, people have lots of different kinds of families. Sometimes your aunt is your primary caregiver. Sometimes your grandmother. Relationships are complicated. So what the president and his merry band want to do is take us back to the eugenic-based racist immigration restriction of the mid-early 20th century, which is going backwards in time rather than forward.
Let's bring in a call now. Sammy joins us in Madison. Hi, Sammy.
Hi there. I'm so happy that we're talking about this. I'm a social work student over at UW-Madison, and one of the things that we kind of always talk about within those social work classes is kind of the structure that has been built in our nation around immigrants. And I know that you all have been kind of talking about this already, but, you know, I think it's important for us to hold the companies and businesses that open up these positions accountable. We keep pointing fingers at one another instead of realizing that the enemy is within this kind of capitalistic structure that we've created. And we've always, you know, had people come in and then we kind of tell them to leave when we don't need them anymore. And what's happening, or what I see in my opinion, is that we're being pitted against each other. The working class is being pitted against each other, against immigrants, and it is becoming very racialized. Instead of holding the companies and businesses accountable for their structures and how they pay people and what jobs they're offering. So at the end of the day, I think that, you know, our government is pandering to those companies instead of really actually coming up with something that makes sense for people, both native-born and immigrants, to have well-paid and secure jobs.
Sammy, thanks for calling in with your perspective. Let's go. Well, actually, Rachel, what is your response to Sammy?
Oh, thanks, Sammy. That's a great point. And, you know, this is something I really take umbrage to when I hear it in debates about building a wall to keep everybody out or clamping down on people who come here to work illegally. The one constant throughout immigration history is that the ranches, the corporations, the huge agribusinesses who need cheap labor, they always get cheap labor. They always get cheap foreign-born labor, no matter what the policy is. So it's absolutely right that Sammy is saying we really need to think about the economics of this in terms of worker parity. There will always be enough labor to pick the crops. There will always be a way to bring those folks in. You know, sometimes temporarily, like when Alabama passed a very restrictive law in 2016, there were not enough people to harvest. So they figured out pretty quickly we need to change things, right? So the problem really is, given that there will be cheap labor super exploited here, how do we ensure basic human rights and needs?
Nearly 700,000 immigrants brought to the U.S. as children and granted DACA status could be deported beginning March 5th if Congress and President Trump fail to reach a deal. The most recent data available from September showed about 690,000 DACA immigrants, known as Dreamers, are currently protected. They include about 7,400 in Wisconsin. We're exploring DACA in Wisconsin this hour with UW-Milwaukee immigrants immigration historian Rachel Ida Buff. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a DACA recipient? Do you live in a household with people of different immigration status? Help us understand your perspective. How do you think the U.S. should reform immigration? Call in or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Last night's State of the Union speech, President Trump said people of all parties should prioritize the protection of American citizens.
My duty and the sacred duty of every elected official in this chamber is to defend Americans, to protect their safety, their families, their communities, and their right to the American dream, because Americans are dreamers too.
Our conversation on migration continues here in the morning show with immigration historian Rachel Ida Buff. She's a professor at UW-Milwaukee, where she's president of the school's chapter of the American Association of University Professors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you hire people for jobs in Wisconsin? Do you consider their citizenship as part of the process? What should Congress and the president do about DACA? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Well, let's take a moment here to discuss. In prime time last night, President Trump spoke at length about gangs and specifically about MS-13. He pointed to parents of two teenage girls who were murdered and gang members charged in their deaths, and he also noted this.
We have sent thousands and thousands and thousands of MS-13 horrible people out of this country or into our prisons.
What context do you think that people should consider when they listen to the president talk about gangs of illegal immigrants?
Could I back up and talk about the first clip you played about Americans are dreamers, too.
Yeah.
I just want to say that I rarely agree with our current sitting president, but I agree with him because dreamers, meaning young people who are brought here and who aspire to stay here and improve the country and their lives and those of their family, are Americans. So Americans are dreamers, and dreamers are Americans. Now, on to MS-13. Unfortunately, as is often the case, the president is somewhat ill-informed, because MS-13 is a gang that began in Los Angeles. Now, it does have predominantly Salvadoran migrants who are involved in it, but this indicates that this is a transnational problem that cannot be resolved. In fact, as it happens, is much worsened by dumping people from the lives they've established in this country back to San Salvador. Now, transnational means we're involved every single day, whether we know it or not, with what goes on in Mexico and Central America. Places like San Salvador and Tegucigalpa, Honduras, are dangerous places. The president has a particular word for them, which I won't use on the radio. They're dangerous because of the legacy of United States foreign policy in destabilizing those countries throughout the 20th century. Deporting people who have established lives in America means they go back to cities where they sometimes speak the language and sometimes don't, very rarely have job connections, and often then wind up having to go into the informal illegal economy. In other words, the president's plan will create bigger and bigger gangs. And as we look at, you know, this is something that the president really likes to talk about, is criminals who are, the vast minority of the foreign-born are criminal elements. Last night was particularly striking because it was curated so that none of the victims, the African-American victims, the numerous African-American victims of police violence whose families were there. None of the victims of the mass shooting in Las Vegas were there. The last night was carefully curated so that you could think that criminal undocumented alien violence is mowing down people in our streets. That's not true. That's how that was selected and portrayed. But just rounding up people for deportation is going to enhance problems of criminality in El Salvador, in Mexico, and in the United States. We are a society that has foreign-born people in it. We are a country that is adjacent to these other countries, and there has to be other solutions besides dumping people back in places that they left for often very good reasons.
Let's bring Marie into the conversation from Appleton. Hi, Marie.
Hi, thank you for letting me call in. I wanted to make just a quick comment, and I do appreciate what you said so far. I wanted to make a comment about you're talking about citing instances where there isn't a negative impact. And on my end of things, I work for a pharmacy benefits manager, and I process claims for a lot of the southern states, which have the STAR and the CHIP program, and they cover a vast majority of the claims that I process. About 95% would be the STAR and CHIP. A lot of them are Texas. Some of them are surrounding states. But I'll process claims for mainly hepatitis and other related diseases that are $30,000 a claim. And where I'm coming from is it just angers me that we have these programs and the vast majority of people that are on these programs in those states are, we'll say a lot of them are undocumented. A lot of them have come here illegally. We do cover the children. But it angers me that as American citizens, those that have come here legally, we don't have money to cover the cancer people. We don't have money to cover our seniors. Seniors can't afford their medication. And the truly needy Americans, but we can pay $30,000 a claim for these. And there are lots of them. It's not just one that I'm citing. So.
Marie, thank you so much for calling in with your personal story and your career story. Rachel Ida Buff, your reaction.
Well, I appreciate Marie's perspective, and I'm just, I think she pointed to this, but let me emphasize that undocumented immigrants are not eligible for CHIP. Their children, if they're born here, are. And I guess I'm so appreciative of Marie's emphasizing the terrible place we find ourselves in this country in terms of austerity for public programs, like public health, like public education. And I understand her frustration with the contrast between the defunding of many of those programs and what she's seeing in her job. However, from both a public health and a humanitarian standpoint, wouldn't it be better, and I'm sorry Marie's not on the line to discuss this with, hepatitis, for example, we want that to be a public health project addressed for everyone because we do live next door to all kinds of people. We're a cosmopolitan, multi-ethnic society. There are going to be people, foreign-born, native-born, from all over the world, riding buses, riding planes with you. You want those people to be healthy for completely selfish reasons. So it seems to me only pragmatic that we want healthy foreign-born people in this country. I think Marie and I differ a little because I would say anyone who comes here and establishes a life here and works here and or raises their family here and makes friends and neighbors here, they are Americans. Luisa Moreno, a Guatemalan American labor organizer, said this in the 1940s, right before they deported her. And I think that's a very beautiful way to think about what our actual lives are like.
Well, as we wrap up here, what chance do members of Congress and the president have in solving America's immigration challenges?
You know, it's really complicated, and what the president has laid out, for example, ending the visa lottery, which he also talked about last night, the visa lottery is a program supported by, initially, Irish and Americans, Senator Kennedy, Tip O'Neill. Now it tends to benefit many Africans. The idea of the visa lottery was, let's bring people in who don't often get favored by immigration. The notion of securing the border, it's a time-honored lie perpetrated by border control people. There's no wall will keep people out when economically we need them here.
Well, we need to stop. I'm sorry, Rachel, we need to stop right here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Rachel Ida Buff is an immigration historian and a professor at UW-Milwaukee, where she's president of the school's chapter of the American Association of University Professors. Her most recent book is called Against the Deportation Terror, Organizing for Immigrant Rights in the 20th Century. She's reading from that book at Boswell Books in Milwaukee. It starts at 7 o'clock Thursday night. Next, we're going to hear from advocates on two different sides of the immigration debate, and your thoughts on immigration are welcome as well. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll return to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. The morning after the State of the Union, we're learning how each side looks at illegal and legal immigration and what to do to solve the country's migration issues. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Center for American Progress estimated last year that the loss of all DACA workers would reduce U.S. gross domestic product by about $460 billion over the next decade. According to the analysis, the result of such a mass deportation could cost Wisconsin millions of dollars. Wisconsin has an estimated 6,440 DACA workers. It would lose in the ballpark of $417 million annually. Matt O'Brien is director of research for FAIR, based in Washington. That's the Federation for American Immigration Reform. The group stands against illegal immigration and advocates for less legal immigration overall. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on. Good morning.
Good morning. The White House released a framework for immigration reform earlier this week, and then, of course, the president's speech last night. What does the president get right?
Well, I think what the president gets right is we have a problem with people violating our immigration laws. The problem is not the laws themselves. The problem is that we have declined to enforce those laws for far too long a time. So I think the president is making a simple point. If you reward bad behavior, you tend to get more bad behavior. So he has proposed greater enforcement, and in order to make his political opponents happy in terms of the situation of the recipients of DACA, he has agreed to a very generous amnesty in order to get the funding that he needs for a physical barrier on the southern border and to increase the number of immigration enforcement personnel.
So where do you see weaknesses in this plan? Where might the plan go wrong?
Well, I think the first mistake that the plan makes is the actual notion that we can gain anything by an amnesty. That's the way politics in D.C. works, unfortunately, from time to time. But we've done an amnesty in the past with the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act, and all that did is create the situation that we currently find ourselves in. The fact is that if you amnesty people, you send a clear message to the rest of the world that if you get here, fly under the radar, and wait long enough, you'll eventually benefit from the next amnesty.
Critics have said immigrants built the U.S. and that rationing citizenship goes against the real American values. What is your response to that?
Well, my response is that from the beginning of the Republic, we have rationed citizenship. There's a big difference between a person who naturalizes and a person who simply disregards the law and comes to the United States without any authorization. And while immigrants have certainly contributed to the building of the United States, if you admit people here without authorization, all you do is place them in a position where they tend to be exploited by employers who are seeking to avoid paying them benefits and want to pay them lower wages.
Well, they're also, as we heard Rachel Ida Buff say earlier, they're fleeing their situations. Usually they're in places that are, you know, they're tenuous. They're not in good circumstances. It's not that they're leaving their countries willy-nilly. So what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, there's a number of things that have to be taken into consideration. Yes, there are a number of people that are legitimately fleeing persecution and other kinds of hard political situations, but we have mechanisms in place to admit those people to the United States under both the refugee and the political asylum programs. There's a lot of other people who are fleeing bad government, and I think one of the questions we never ask is what responsibility do people have to fix their problems at home before they start to flee their own countries? And the simple fact of the matter is that the United States cannot absorb everyone who is unhappy with their situation in their own country. That's an absurd notion.
Let's go to Chris, who joins us in Columbus. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Yeah, I'm glad that we're having an intellectual discussion on it. Good job. You know, I'm saddened by both your first guest and President Trump. They're both wrong, and they're both right. Your first guest talked about the 1924 immigration change, but she failed to talk about how that change was because politically we saw too many Slavic peoples coming in, and oh my goodness, they weren't American enough. Let's open up the southern border because our neighbors to the south will generously come and fulfill the labor needs we have and then return home. And it's a political problem, and it's never fixed by politics. I think that we should actually kind of do a little bit of a, chain migration is our history. My ancestors came that way. We're not going to stop that. And no Republican, and I speak as a active member, is going to vote to throw DACA recipients or participants out. However, I believe that we're a nation of laws. And if we're going to hold President Trump's feet to the fire, and we should hold everyone's feet to the fire. And if you are not in this country legally, you should step across the border, get back in line, and come back in legally. I think we should open it up. If you can speak English, read English, and don't have a criminal record, come on in.
Chris, I'm going to leave it right there and let Matt O'Brien respond. Go ahead.
Well, I think there's some merit to that. And one of the propositions that President Trump has made is a merit-based immigration system that works on a points basis where you gain points for having job skills, you gain points for being able to speak, read, and write English. I'm not sure we're in a position in the United States, given the attraction of the United States to so many people from around the world, to open anything up. The fact is that if we want to maintain our national security and public safety, then we need to regulate the number of people who are coming to the United States, but also the circumstances under which they come here.
Chris, thanks so much for bringing your perspective this morning. Matt, enforcing immigration limits is pricey. Even building a wall between Mexico and the U.S. carries a really hefty price tag. Why are stricter immigration laws worse than the taxpayer cost?
Well, enforcing the immigration laws is a lot less expensive than the roughly $116 billion a year cost of unlawful immigration to the United States. The fact is that we're a very generous country. A lot of benefits programs, particularly at the state level, are available to people who are here unlawfully. There are also a number of federal programs that the states have the choice to decide who they administer them to, and people who are here unlawfully access those programs, plus people who came here unlawfully but had children in the United States. Under the current interpretation of the law, their children are citizens, so they are able to access all of those benefit programs. That places a hefty burden on the American taxpayer. If we enforced our immigration laws and were more selective about who we let in, the fact is that the cost would greatly decrease. But right now, the problem is not immigration per se, it's illegal immigration.
Matt O'Brien is with us, Director of Research for FAIR, that is the Federation for American Immigration Reform. The group stands against illegal immigration and advocates for less legal immigration overall. Let's go to Don in Harvard, Illinois. Hi, Don.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to relate my experience as having been a victim of illegal alien crime. I suffered a midnight home invasion by an illegal alien from Mexico. It was very terrifying, and it forced me out of my house and out of my community. It resulted in gangs moving into the neighborhood and taking the whole place over. I am deeply concerned about the role that Wisconsin has taken in this, because I live just over the border in Illinois, and there was a problem with people from Mexico going up into Wisconsin to get Wisconsin license plates and then coming and moving into Illinois so they could drive around legally with Wisconsin license plates. One of our elderly citizens, an 83-year-old lady, was brutally murdered on Mother's Day of 2006. She was strangled by an illegal alien from Mexico. This is a very serious problem, and I disagree greatly with the guest you had on earlier.
Don, thank you so much. Let's get Matt O'Brien to respond.
Well, Don points out a very serious problem. If you have people who are operating under the radar, we have no idea who they are, they have not been vetted, we don't know whether they have a criminal background or a terrorist background or whether they're affiliated with a foreign intelligence agency or anything of that nature. Now, terrorism has become a big deal in terms of the global security climate, particularly since September 11th. But there have always been and there always will be criminals, and criminals are typically attracted to situations where they can operate in the shadows. And one of the reasons that MS-13 and other gangs have exploited the flaws in our immigration enforcement is because they can come in and then they can in turn exploit the status of other people that are here illegally by threatening their families back home, based on the notion that these individuals will not be able to go to law enforcement, or by threatening them with reporting them to immigration authorities. So it's a bad situation all around.
So as we wrap up here quickly, Matt, what would be the most important values people should consider as we're deciding in America what we think about immigration here?
Well, I think there's two important things. Number one, we are a nation ruled by the rule of law. And if you pass laws and then don't adhere to them, you send a clear message that the law doesn't matter. And that creates all kinds of problems, not just in immigration, but in other areas. The other thing is there is sort of this notion that enforcing immigration law is bad, and yet we don't apply that to any other area of law. I mean, the fact is there are many people who get convicted of murder or felony theft who have families and who will wind up separated from their families if we send them to jail, but we don't think it's inappropriate to send them to jail. So I think at some point we have to see this as a policy issue. We need to regulate immigration both for the benefit of American citizens but also for the benefit of people coming here so they are not exploited by unscrupulous employers, by criminal groups, and so on and so forth.
Well, Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. Have a great day.
You too. Matt O'Brien is Director of Research for FAIR, based in Washington. That's the Federation for American Immigration Reform. The group stands against illegal immigration and advocates for less legal immigration. Now we turn to an advocate who argues America should embrace immigrants. Daryl Modine is State Secretary for LULAC, Wisconsin. That's the League of United Latin American Citizens. Daryl, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me this morning.
President Trump talked about a plan for immigration, of course, during last night's State of the Union. What problems, as you see him laying out the case for it, what problems do you see with the administration's proposal?
Well, I disappointingly see the president's current plan as a non-starter, and I think you're seeing that from folks on both sides of the aisle right now. You know, I think everybody had high expectations when we saw a very highly publicized meeting about 2 weeks ago now, where he brought together people from both sides of the aisle and said, bring me a bipartisan solution that meets these criteria. And once they did, he promptly knocked it down. So unfortunately, there's a lot of concern right now on both sides of the aisle.
Can you find common ground with the president on any facet of the plan?
Well, what's interesting is when we talk to leadership and the rank and file on both sides in Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, there is a tremendous sense of wanting to get this done. I mean, when you look at polls from almost anyone, including Fox, you're going to see about 85% of Americans agree that these DACA recipients and these Dreamers should be given a pathway to stay in the country. And like 75 or 76% of those are Republicans as well. So I know the sense we get in working the Hill is that there's frustration on both sides that the president's making it as difficult as he is.
Critics say illegal immigration is bad for the country on the basis of safety, and we heard a caller on that as well, a personal story there. They say people should come to America through proper channels. So how do you respond, and how do you make those channels above board and proper and fair?
Wow. If only you and I had a couple of hours to talk through that this morning. Well, a couple of things. First off, everybody thinks that there's a line that people can step into to come here the right way. There is no line for the majority of these DACA recipients and Dreamers. Those who are eligible have already gotten into it and have adjusted their status that way. There is no line simply for a person who wants to come to America to get into, and if they wait long enough, they can. Right now, the backlog is somewhere between 15, and I've seen it as high as 19 years, as a waiting list for those who would be eligible to come in. So just to kind of give perspective there. But secondly, to the issue of crime, let me just say that per the FBI statistics and numerous studies, it's been proven that it's statistically safer to live in an immigrant community than not. I'll say that again. It's statistically safer to live in an immigrant community than not. Are there bad folks? As with any category of individual or any demographic in the population, of course there are. But it is, and we're all in favor of people who do violent crimes, who sell drugs, those types of things. Those are the people we think immigration should be focusing on, not on the hardworking individuals trying to provide for their families.
What effect do undocumented workers have on the economy here in the U.S.? If employers are breaking the law, hiring people without papers, can't they pay them less and keep jobs from American workers, American citizens?
I'm so glad you brought that up. You know, when I first got asked to help with this initiative, I had my doubts like everybody else. You know, I went out on the internet and I started looking at information. Is this a just cause? Right? That's what I wanted to find out. And right away, I started finding these websites with all this phenomenal research and information. And I thought, wow, maybe this isn't something I can't get behind. Maybe I've been wrong this whole time. And then I stumbled upon some testimony by Nina Olson, who's the chief taxpayer advocate. Because here all these websites were saying, you know, immigrants just take from our community. They don't contribute $160 billion a year, net loss, et cetera. And then I see her here talking about how she was instructed by Congress to set up a system with the IRS by which undocumented immigrants are to pay taxes. And then I read on in her testimony, and she starts talking about this thing, this algorithm, and they call it substantial presence, by which undocumented immigrants, on average, have to pay a higher tax rate. And the deeper and deeper I dug, the more and more I was surprised. The Social Security Administration actually estimates that about 75% of all undocumented immigrants pay full taxes. That's at the state level and at the federal level. So they're paying into Social Security, even though they're not eligible. They're paying into Medicare, even though they're not eligible. They're paying into unemployment insurance, even though they're not eligible. And the list goes on and on. So the net benefit is when I looked at the CBO and when I looked at nonpartisan organizations, there's definitely a net benefit to our country to having them here in the tens of billions of dollars annually.
House Speaker Paul Ryan points to President Obama for the U.S. falling down on immigration, and he said last September, quote, President Obama's DACA program was a clear abuse of executive authority, an attempt to create law out of thin air. Just as the courts have already struck down similar Obama policy, this was never a viable long-term solution to this challenge. Where did the Obama administration go wrong on immigration policy? Where did Democrats lose their way, if any, do you think, on immigration?
Well, I'll share this, and I know it's not a very popular opinion, but it's merely the truth. We've had multiple opportunities to have comprehensive immigration reform, and I've seen efforts on both sides of the aisle to kill it, each for their own political reasons, which has been very disappointing. With regards to Speaker Ryan, I can share with you, in speaking with numerous constitutional attorneys, it's really unclear as to whether DACA in its current form does meet constitutional muster. I've spoken with individuals who come down on both sides of the aisle. I will share this with you. Every president since Eisenhower has used this authority in a similar way, with the biggest users being both President Bush's. So there is a lot of precedent there to have it. I will share this, though, with regards to Speaker. I know this is something that he has spoken out on loudly, and I've heard him on numerous occasions simply say, we need to increase the pipeline, a regulated pipeline, to get people in here, because we're seeing recorded numbers of folks going onto Social Security and Medicare, and we just don't have enough working people right now to sustain that. So I know he's advocating for that, but we'll see what happens.
People who disagree with the DACA program say some recipients do remember their home countries and do have family there, do speak the language. Is it enough to argue that age should play such a crucial role in the immigration debate?
You know, I think the key word there is some. Right. So we know per DACA, in order for someone to be eligible, they must have arrived here at, you know, under the age of 16. So a 15-year-old or younger. Boy, we don't even let those our kids, our own children, drive cars on our streets at that age. So they did come here as younger. A substantial number came at a very young age. So I think that does play a role. Statistics do show us about 90% of these individuals did come from Latin America, but there are some from throughout the world, et cetera. So for the most part, when I meet and I see and I speak with some of these individuals, it's just amazing what they're doing. Obviously, we have some in the military serving. We had that great tragedy down in Harvey where a DACA recipient gave his life to rescue those who were in fear of dying in the hurricane. And they continue to do great things. That being said, is everybody perfect? No. And that's why in all the pieces of legislation being discussed, there are things that say, okay, before this happens, they must have a clean record, they must learn English, they must be employed, and they must be contributing. And those are all things that DACA recipients are doing already. You know, over 95% are employed or in school and paying taxes. They're buying homes, they're buying cars, so it's raising property values and stimulating manufacturing. Boy, they're paying over $40 billion over the next 10 years if they're allowed to stay into Social Security and Medicare, so there's huge benefits to having them here.
Well, Daryl Modine, I'm sorry. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me and for really stimulating this intellectual debate on the issue. Really appreciate it.
Daryl Modine is State Secretary for LULAC, Wisconsin. That's the League of United Latin American Citizens. He finished this hour's conversation about DACA and immigration. Earlier, we heard from Matt O'Brien with the Federation for American Immigration Reform. We talked with University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee immigration historian Rachel Ida Buff as well. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina and Chris Molina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation on immigration challenges, you heard it on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening.